Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle. Hello and welcome to the property planner, buyer and professor. As always, I'm joined by my two fabulous co-hosts, Peter Kalizos and Kate Bakos. How are you both today?
Good to be with you, Dave.
Very good. Thank you, Dave.
Good to hear, good to hear. And how's your week been, Pete?
Yeah, it's great. The first 2 weeks of uni are over, so the frenzy is gone. So we're settling down, which is terrific. Wish I could say the same for the property market, but there is still a huge frenzy there, as has been illustrated by the ABS stats and the CoreLogic stats that have come out. According to the ABS, this is up to the December quarter, so the last 3 months of last year, every capital city did at least somewhere between 2.6% and 3.4%. Now, if you annualise that, that means that every capital city is going to do between 10 to 15% for those 12 months, which I don't think is far off the mark. And then we look at CoreLogic, which is more recent, and the 3 months to the 16th of March, which is when we're recording, Sydney 5%. In the last 3 months, Melbourne 4%, Brisbane almost 5%, Adelaide almost 3%, Perth 4.5%. So it's showing that the market is certainly moving up. I've said a number of times, I haven't seen anything like I'm seeing this time around. It's even, you know, more frenetic than it was in 2001, 2 and 3. But, you know, Kate, who's on the ground every weekend going to auctions, I'm sure she's got a much better idea of what's happening at the coalface.
Yeah, let me double up how I'm doing with our market update in the interests of being efficient. I've had a really hard week with getting successful offers across the line. And the reason isn't because I'm getting smashed by other buyer's agents. In fact, I haven't seen buyer's agents winning auctions at all. And the toughest thing that we're finding is we're up against first home buyers who are parent-backed, and some of them are doing quite irrational things. So, for example, I had an auction that I was going to this weekend. I thought the property might have pipped $1 million. I didn't see it hitting 1.1, but that would have been a result that could have been based on really high competition. Anyway, the agent texted us all yesterday to say, auction cancelled. We've just received an offer of 1.22. Now, I was in shock. I had to call him to verify that he hadn't got a digit wrong. And I confirmed who it was, and it was a first home buyer who's sick of getting pipped. That's an enormous premium to pay, and I think what we're seeing now is irrational behaviour also. And some buyers aren't rattled by that because they don't need to worry about valuation shortfalls if they're gifted a lot of money or if they've got parental support with guarantees that have boundless equity reserves. But for anyone who isn't in that fortunate position, a killer bid like that could really pull things undone for you if the valuation comes in short and you can't cover it.
The Bank of Mum and Dad, the fifth largest lender in our country, is becoming a real differentiator for a number of first-time buyers.
Absolutely. But it's fueling some of this growth, there's no doubt about it. You know, if you've got a Bank of Mum and Dad, there's no servicing calculator there and there's no focus from a credit assessor on the security itself, because you've got a lot of asset backing and we're seeing a bit of that.
And we really won't know with some of these outlandish prices whether they were smart moves or, you know, way over the top for, it might be 2 years, it might be 5 years, it might be 7 years, all depends how long the individuals can hold the properties for as well. So there sure is very, very strong competition out there.
Buyers have to ask themselves, not only will they regret it if the market stabilises and they're caught underwater, that's one risk, and if it's a really great asset and it's a long-term buy and hold and things don't go wrong, your relationship doesn't break up, etc., etc., you might turn around in 10 years and say, look, it was an insignificant stretch in hindsight, But if things go wrong, it can hurt. The other thing that they have to think about is the lost opportunity. If you're spending your money on a killer bid for something that's not deserving of the price you've paid, it means there's other assets out there that are better for the same price. You've really got to think about that.
Yeah, quite possibly. But then again, you're also potentially setting new benchmarks that other people will start to follow, rightly or wrongly as well. But it does reinforce the importance of having a long-term plan and being able to hold the property for the long term, because every year you hold the property, the less that higher knockout price has the potential to bite you in the backside.
And I hope that valuers are doing their homework and speaking to people like Kate to work out, you know, are these, you know, market bids or are these irrational bids? Because if they're irrational bids, then valuers shouldn't be saying, well, the value of the property is what you paid for it.
We all know that a valuer might look at an auction result like that. They could say, hey, it's a reflection of market value. If it's really peaky, valuers will ask the agents, hey, what happened at this auction? I've seen valuations come in short on auction results. But when it's a pre-auction offer, that big punchy blow that knocks others out, that's where valuations can come in short. You can be very, very careful about doing a pre-auction offer that's meaty if you haven't got contingency.
Definitely. Yeah, that's exactly the type of example where we've seen valuations fall short. You know, that can make a serious difference to people. Let's say this example, Kate, what did they pay? 1.22 mil?
Yep.
And let's say the value of, you thought value was around 1.1-ish.
That would have been a strong result. Yeah.
So let's say if the value is at 1.12, which sounds pretty high, that's an extra, and they're borrowing at 80%. Yeah, that's an extra $80,000 they've got to find a way to come up with.
Yeah.
So the valuation definition, which I've talked about in previous podcasts, is the estimated sale price between a willing buyer and a willing seller. Problem is, we've got some very, very willing buyers and obviously people willing to sell. Yes, it is an arm's length transaction, and after proper marketing and where the parties had each acted knowledgeably, prudently and without compulsion. But Kate mentioned a great word there. It's irrational. You know, I went to an auction on Saturday myself where I thought, oh, look, max it's worth $950. And then it went sold for $1.2. But that's not like one person said it was worth $1.2. The person before them said it was worth $1.195. And the person before them said it was worth $1.19. So, like, everyone's just getting caught up in this and driving the market up very, very quickly. Well, I mean, which is, you know, great if you own property, but this is just not sustainable. People need to remember this rate of increase is not going to be around for very long.
Yeah, it's not sustainable for a long period of time, but, you know, with decisions like this, it's not really, again, until the dust settles at some point down the track that we really know whether it was a smart decision or not. I mean, I was doing the maths in my head. Hopefully I got it right, Pete. You did say some of it on the ABS numbers and the CoreLogic numbers. So you said the ABS numbers, which was for the last quarter, that's right, of 2020.
Up to December, yeah, last year.
And they were basically extrapolating out to 10 or 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did the CoreLogic ones in my head, and they seem to be extrapolating out to between 15 and 20%, which is the first quarter of this year. And, you know, I think that's actually where I would be not surprised at all. I guess, been talking to people off the record that I think this year might break new records and could end up sitting 15 to 20% growth across. And we're starting to see that if you extrapolate out. So then I guess people are probably starting to think about, okay, well, here's what market value might be. If I add 10%, 15%, 20%, what does that look like? And making decisions around that. So
I think, as Kate will attest to, the first 3 months of this year have been very different to the last 3 months of last year.
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot more panic or frenzy in the market at the moment.
Interestingly,
yeah, tip to another level.
If we turn the clock just to pre-COVID last year, so we're only just 1 year into COVID officially hitting our shores and being denoted a pandemic. Before that, though, our February and early March last year was pretty heady as well. It was already ramping up to be strong. Yeah. And that was, as you said, Dave, you know, we had the Banking Royal Commission come to a close, the memories were fading, the interest rates were really low, and that was starting to grip. We already saw the promise of a really strong year last year until COVID hit. So we've just picked up where we left off, but we've chucked a bit more fuel on the fire.
100%. More fuel on the fire, and that most of that fuel is the really low interest rates. And, you know, we're just getting to a point where a number of the capital cities have reached the highest median value, but that's with then historically. So they've been at these values previously, but rates were much higher. So it says, in theory, there's a lot more affordability to go beyond the levels we're at. You know, I think is it Perth, Darwin and Melbourne who still haven't hit their record high medians as yet. So, yeah, I think we've still got a ways to go. And just on that, yeah, you watch many things to sort of predict where things are heading. And, you know, we've shared before how New Zealand property prices had grown by 16%. Well, they've now grown by around 20% over the last 12 months. So they've made an interesting decision, the first government, Jacinda Ardern's government, the first in the world, to actually include in the Reserve Bank's remit to factor in stabilising house prices as part of their decision-making on interest rates. So a lot of people would think that that is part of the RBA's remit, but it's not. It's part of APRA's remit. So that'll be interesting to watch this space. The New Zealand government led the way in 1989 to have their Reserve Bank to be the first one ever to target inflation. Now, every Reserve Bank targets inflation nowadays. Australia's is in between 2 to 3%. So that's a could be a little harbinger of what's to come with Reserve Bank policy that will have an absolute another major impact on being a price maker in the property market. And something, if it catches on with other governments, will be something every person involved in the property industry will be constantly watching and a new talking point. Just quickly, globally, we've had the biggest house price growth since 2016 during the year of the pandemic, 2020. So it just shows this is a worldwide phenomenon. And I think that'll be even larger in 2021. Even though we've had this price growth, we're lagging Canada, New Zealand and the USA in terms of price growth. And just quickly, APRA released data on the December quarter that the number of people who have debt-to-income ratio of 6 times greater than their debt levels has almost doubled from 11,000 to 21,000. But APRA is saying at this stage that's not a concern because it's still broadly in line with historical averages. But I think that's another watch this space. Been talking about APRA a bit, and Kate, you mentioned in the last week or two that we hadn't seen many articles mentioning APRA, but surprise, surprise, this week there's nearly been one in the paper every day. So maybe they've been listening to our podcast.
Governor Lowe has not been hinting at interest rate increases in the short term at all. So the headlines and the news and the talk about interest rates going up is fictitious. And journalists have to be really careful about what they put out there because I've had so many inquiries from people that are asking me what happens when interest rates go up and should we be buffering. You absolutely should keep that in mind, of course, but I've seen no evidence to suggest that in the short term we're about to have our rates increased. In fact, we've had information direct from our governor that for now they're staying low and they've got bigger fish to fry than worrying about the property market.
Absolutely, and people are confusing the long-term bond yields with what's going to actually happen with interest rates and the Reserve Banks, because long-term bond yields are going up.
Yep.
And that's like, for example, 10 years, they've gone up to sort of 1.8%, give or take. But that's saying, you know, over the next 10 years, you know, they think rates are going to increase, which, you know,
still marginally.
That makes sense.
I mean, 1.8, that's not like we're suggesting double-digit interest rates.
Exactly. Historically, that's still very low.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. Well, we better get into today's episode. And today's episode is the 7 S's of property investment. The 7 S's, as dictated by Peter Kalizos: state, city, suburb, street, style, size, and soil, aka land. And you might note city, yes, it doesn't start with an S, but it sounds like one. Probably my young kids would spell it with an S. So
yeah, phonetic alphabet today.
Yeah, that's right. So, Pete, you've written an article on this, which we'll share with everyone. And why are these the 7 S's? Why don't we start with number one, state? Why is selecting the state important?
So what I've done is try to look top down. So we're looking at big picture. So the first four S's are related to location. We start with the state. So if you're looking to invest in property, even before the state, we look at what's happening globally and nationally. And as we've just said in this particular podcast, the property markets generally around the world are doing quite well. So if you reckon that Australia is a good place to invest in, then you have to pick a particular state. So have a look at which states are doing well, which states may not be doing so well. So for example, you know, if international tourism is going to take a big hit this year, then maybe Queensland might take a big hit because they're very dependent on international tourism. Whereas at the other end of the country, Western Australia, the price of iron ore is at record prices. So maybe the Western Australian state government coffers will look very, very healthy in the short term, certainly. Then once you've worked out your state, then you've got to work out, are you going to invest in the city or in a regional town? So again, we're doing some more research on if we're going to go into a regional area, and Kate's our expert here on regional areas, especially in Victoria, what's this particular regional area got going for it? So again, if this particular regional area has a university in it and the university is heavily dependent on international students, well, maybe they're going to take a little bit of a hit because we are certainly down on international student numbers. We have tried to compensate for that by attracting more domestic students, but that's just one aspect. You've got to also look at the capital growth drivers in not just the capital city, but what's driving the capital growth of properties in those regional areas. So, Kate, I know you're very active in places like Ballarat and Bendigo, and you sent me a text one Sunday to say how surprised you were at what was happening in Ballarat.
Yeah. Yeah, cities have their own, obviously they're an LGA, so they've got their own funding, they've got employment opportunities, and you've got to look really carefully at what a mandate is for a city, particularly the regions. And, you know, there's some really fine work out there by some of our industry colleagues on specific regions, and we don't just look at a single employer scenario. But taking Ballarat as an example, Pete, I sent you that text because we went for the long weekend with friends and I'd talked up a couple of new wine bars. I had no idea how busy and bustling it would be on a Sunday night of a long weekend at midnight in Ballarat, and the gin bars, all of the changes to this city were definitely demonstrating that not only are the locals starting to enjoy going out, but it's attracting a lot of city people like myself for weekend times away and for good times with friends. And that's showing that the demographic is shifting as well, or they're catering to that demographic that's enjoying it, because 10 years ago, a gin bar would not have survived in Ballarat. When you look really carefully at the employment opportunities and the people that are moving into the city, it is changing. So you've got to be prepared to do some demographic research if you're picking a city for its potential to have short-term growth.
Kate, didn't you say in that text that 10 years ago the only place you could get a percolated coffee was at Mac's?
Yeah.
Times have changed in Ballarat.
Things have certainly streaked ahead there.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
All right, so once we've done the state, the city or the town, then we have to look at a particular suburb. If we're using Ballarat as an example as a regional area, I'm sure, Kate, that there are some suburbs in Ballarat you would highly seek out, and then there are other suburbs that you would not be interested in.
Oh, I like doing this. Reasons. What a great way to cross-section Ballarat. Yes, so if you're buying in Ballarat to live in and you're wanting to replicate that kind of Fitzroy Grove and you like the little corner shop serving coffee around the corner and you love that beautiful Hawthorne brick architecture, well, you'll head to Soldiers Hill. If you want to pick an area that you might get some short-term growth because of subdivision activity and developer interest, well, you'll do your research and you might target parts of Ballarat East or Eureka. And I won't name suburbs because it could upset people, but there are some suburbs in Ballarat that are so dodgy, property managers won't touch them and won't take on stock in those suburbs. So you have to know your suburbs. It's a very eclectic city.
Yeah, and that goes with anywhere because we keep saying that location is the most important thing when it comes to property, and that's because you can't change your location. You can change the house, like you can even knock down the house if you want, other than, you know, you might extend it or renovate it. You can add to the size of the land by maybe buying the neighbour's land or subdivide and make your land smaller. But the thing that you cannot change is where you are located. You can't change the state you're in, the city you're in, the suburb you're in, which is what we've just talked about, nor the street. So after you've picked your suburb, then there are certain streets you need to focus on. So, you know, a no-brainer is you shouldn't be buying a residential property to live in on a really busy main road, because you'll buy it cheap, but then you will also sell it cheap. So you're going to be really limited with its capital growth. So in my opinion, generally you need to look for wide streets. They're going to be a bit hard to find in our inner city suburbs, but if you can, wide, tree-lined, houses set back from the front boundary. Again, a bit hard in our inner city suburbs, especially of Sydney and Melbourne. But most importantly, your street needs to be lined with other appealing houses. You do not want to be buying the best house in the worst street. You want to be doing the opposite. You want to be buying a house that has potential for maybe upgrading or improving the condition, because one of the reasons that your property will grow in value is because the other nice houses in the street will help increase your property price. So, Dave, they're the four S's that relate to location: state, city, suburb, and street.
I love it.
Great run through of the first four S's. Pete, I didn't even need to chime in or ask a question.
Sorry, mate. I
rolled them through.
I talk for a living, so I have no problem.
I love it. Hey, let's talk a bit more about street, because Pete's absolutely right. You've got to know the difference between your streets. And when it's a blue chip suburb or a highly revered suburb, you'll know the top streets, and we all know our own suburb's best streets. But when it's a gentrifying suburb, you'll want to be able to pick what could be the A-grade street when that suburb's had its facelift. And so many people who are targeting gentrifying suburbs end the call and the consult with me by saying, oh, and if you could make it big enough so that it's got subdivision potential, that would be great. And there's more to subdivision potential than the size of the land, as Pete will know, he's nodding. It's all about the zoning and the overlays and any restrictions, covenants, etc. You've got to have a really good mind for planning, or have a plan on your side to be certain about what you can and can't subdivide. But if you're certain you can subdivide, it means that your neighbours probably can too. And unless you're planning on getting your hands dirty quickly and doing your subdivision and making your money and getting out, you might be buying a property and sitting on it while everyone around you is subdividing, and all of a sudden in a gentrifying area, you could be on a street with really cheap townhouse builds catering to first home buyers at a price for a developer to quickly make their money and get out. All of a sudden, what could have been a pretty street is a pretty ugly street. So there's something to be said for chasing development potential when you're not a developer and you're not planning on doing a development.
Yep, that's a really good point. And some other characteristics of an A-grade street: it not being a cut-through street, so usually a dead-end street. So, you know, there's some beautiful streets, say, around, well, most suburbs, but if I think about where we live, some of them, there's a cut-through from one major road to another, which gets heaps of usage during the morning, you know, school pickup, to and from work. So these are the just small things that might seem reasonably incremental that people don't pick up when they're looking to purchase a property at times. Other key considerations of an A-grade street is the walking distance to the key set of shops, public transport. Now, that depends obviously on the city you're looking to purchase in, but I would say generally speaking, you know, you'd want to be around 800 metres to 1.2 k's walking distance to the public transport and the core local set of shops to be a genuine A-grade street. Now, you might be willing to compromise to a B-grade street on some of these sort of aspects that we've touched on that make a top street. But, you know, if you want to actually select the top A-grade streets, you want to tick all of these boxes. And one of the best ways to start, if you don't know the location, is look at a map. You can actually pick out what are likely to be A-grade streets from looking at the map of pretty much any suburb or town, as Pete, you were alluding to before, and then go and drive around them and see if they actually reflect that and have the rest of these characteristics. A very common one in Melbourne is tree-lined streets. you know, if you've got trees that have been there for 50, 100, 100 plus years, they certainly add a beauty and often connected to the A-grade streets as well. So is there any, in terms of A-grade streets, is there anything else?
Yep. I always look for a street that has a larger proportion of house blocks to unit blocks. So if more than half of the blocks are units, you might have an issue with parking, but you'll also have an issue with street scope. And, you know, the closer you get in, the more that's a threat. So trying to apply that rule in Elwood, you'll have a very hard time. So there are, you know, some areas where you'll flex the rules because they are apartment centric. And then there's also orientation. So there's obviously the favoured side of the street if it's a north-south orientation street. Bus routes. If you've got a bus on your street, yeah, it might be convenient, but you'll also hear that noise every couple of minutes.
And you don't want the stop to be out the front of your house.
No.
Yeah, so street and consistency of the streetscape as well. So the style of properties is important.
Oh, you've picked the next one, Dave.
Very good, Dave. Excellent segue there.
Right. All right, let's go into style. The fifth S.
So the best styles of property, especially in our eastern and southern states, are what we call period character style buildings. So these properties were generally built before World War II. And if I'm looking at South Australia, we cottages, in particular symmetrical cottages, bungalows, Californian bungalows, and there is that style in other states. Villas, return veranda villas, Queen Anne villas. Kate, you've got some fantastic period styles in Victoria. Why don't you rattle some off?
Well, Victorian Edwardian Federation, I absolutely love those areas. And then we're looking at pre-war, interwar, post-war. So we've got some really gorgeous character in our older areas. But talk to a millennial, they get really excited about what they call mid-century, which is really closer to like 1970s sunken lounges and exposed rafters. So we've got some really good consistent styles in various areas. If you head to Eltham, Warrandyte, some of those leafy outer northeastern areas, you'll get all of those beautiful mid-century homes in spades.
Yes, and some of the classic characteristics in those homes are timber floorboards, stone fronts, maybe red brick coins, high ceilings, fancy ceilings, maybe some fireplaces. These are the sorts of things that many people are looking for in those character or period style homes.
Mm, you head down to Battery Point and walk around Hobart or go to Sydney and check out some of those areas that are within walking distance to the rocks and you'll get colonial style, and that's a sight to behold. They're beautiful.
Certainly.
That is the fifth S, style. So number six, size, Pete. Why does size matter?
Yeah, so certainly size does matter, especially the size of the dwelling, but much bigger is not always much better. If I can use an extreme example, so a seven-bedroom home might look fantastic, but it's not very practical when it comes to finding a tenant, because most tenants are not interested in seven-bedroom homes. And it's also going to diminish your capital growth prospects because most owner-occupiers are not looking for a seven-bedroom home. And so if you've actually bought such a large home, what you've probably done is put most of your money into the depreciating component of the property, which is the building, rather than the appreciating component of the property, which is the land. So size does matter, and in simple terms for me, houses are better than units, in particular three-bedroom houses. And now with COVID-19, I think four-bedroom homes are also becoming more popular. Two-bedroom homes have really lost their popularity. Is that right, Kate?
If you've got an inability to work or study conveniently out of your living area, you might have an issue. And we saw that enormous shift to open plan everything a while ago, and a lot of people converted a two-bedroom closed lounge property into an expensive, potentially overcapitalised two-bedroom open plan. Now, if you can't work in a study environment from home without your kids in the background or someone making their breakfast, you might have an issue. I've maintained this, though. The COVID year that we've had has been horrible and it's reshaped a lot of people's thinking, but there's a degree of elasticity to that. We'll see a lot of people bounce back to what they had. It's not necessarily a permanent shift for every single family unit.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, are going to be landing on 2 to 3, maybe 4 days in the office. So it isn't going to be as discomforting if they don't have, you know, a locked away study or even two spaces for both adults in the house being able to work separately. There's definitely going to be a change and it's going to be lasting, but how large it's going to be, time will tell. But I think three bedrooms and a study, two bedrooms and a study is certainly the desirability being heightened is here to stay. But as you said, Kate, there's some elasticity to that. Anything else on size, Pete, before we move into number seven?
No.
Soil, aka land.
Land. That's right. That's the best synonym I could come up with for land, and that starts with an S is soil. So really what I've talked about so far is location, looks, and which is, comes into style, and now land. So if you want to make money in property, you want to make sure that your property has a significant component of land. But bigger is not always better. Again, what's more important is the location of that land. So a house on a large block of land, but on the outskirts of the metropolitan area, which has limited access to amenities and facilities, is probably not the best when it comes to capital growth when you compare it to a property on a smaller block, but it's closer to the city. Now, not everyone can afford to buy a house. Okay. So if you can't afford to buy a house, number one, never buy a high-rise apartment. But what you could do is buy a flat or a unit, so an older style flat or unit, which is in a small group. So even though the flat or unit shares the block with other flats and units, it doesn't share it with hundreds of other high-rise apartments. So you want to make, in summary, you want to make sure you're buying a property which has a reasonable land component with it.
Yeah, what we call land to asset ratio.
Yeah,
which that's true. We've had an episode on, and I think we've had an episode on the considerations when you're subdividing as well, which everybody can listen to. In terms of land to asset ratio, Kate, would you like to add anything there?
Yeah, land is a great one to chat about because so many people have the false belief that big land is best no matter where it is. And I've said it so many times on this podcast and people who know me will have heard me say it as well. I'd rather have 100 square metres in an A-grade inner ring location, you know, obviously a good street is critical, than a 700 square metre block in the fringe. And we've got to look at the land value, not the land size, but land to asset ratio is a guiding principle for all of us. And it underpins my selection of assets. We've talked about all of the critical components today with Pete, and land to asset ratio is a really good initial test for any property that I'm shortlisting, because if the dwelling is worth more than the land, we've got a problem when it comes to capital growth, particularly in the first few years.
Yeah, and for those who haven't listened to that episode or heard us explain it before, the land to asset ratio is the percentage of the overall value of the property that's made up in the land component. So for example, $1 million property, if the house burnt down and you're just left with the land, you'd want the land to be worth $700,000, give or take. Ideal land to asset ratio in that case would be 70%, which is ballpark around, you know, it probably sits depending on the property type and style and location somewhere between 60 to 80%. If you get too high above 80% land to asset ratio, you then end up with probably a reasonably dilapidated dwelling on top that isn't fun to live in for your tenants. You might get troublesome tenants, a pretty low rental yield. You might have heaps of maintenance that work that you hadn't planned for. So that's why, you know, sort of circa 60 to 80%, somewhere in around there, maybe as low as 50% is what we look for in a outperforming investment when it comes to the land to asset ratio. Okay, so that's the seven S's. If you're going to sum up that journey, that cascading journey of the seven S's, Pete, to wrap us up and for our listeners today before we get into the gold nuggets.
Yeah, well, I could translate those seven S's to the three L's, which is location, land, and looks. And I'll give you some more detail, intriguing detail about those three L's in the gold nuggets. But if you can't remember the seven S's, it's the three L's, location, land, and looks.
I love it.
Great acronym. You've got acronyms for everything, Pete. Awesome. Well, that's been a fantastic summary of how to go about the key levels of selecting your property purchase. And, I can't wait to hear the gold nuggets from you both. If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
I'll start with you, Kate. What's your gold nugget for the seven S's?
Yeah, hopefully it's not the seven F's.
You've had the seven F's when you've been bidding for properties on the weekend.
I've had more than seven. I'm going to throw in a cheeky eighth S, and that is sentiment. So after you've applied your seven S's, ask yourself, what's the sentiment for this property? Because as an investor, or if you're choosing something based on its investment potential, the sentiment associated with that property from mainstream buyers has to be good. It has to be positive. If there's a negative sentiment there and you're buying a bad bargain, it's like Pete's bad bag of apples, you're making a mistake. And if you're worried that it's such an appealing property to the mainstream that you've got competition, take that as a positive sign. Be prepared for competition, because good quality properties attract competition. So make sure your sentiment on your sentiment meter is rating really strongly.
Might have to add an eighth S, Pete.
Yeah, I think we do. Very good, Kate. I like it.
And Pete, what's your gold nugget for the day?
We shrunk the seven S's to the three L's: location, land and look. So when it comes to location, you want to be pretty close to the city or very, very close to the sea. Ideally Esplanade, or not too far away from the Esplanade. When it comes to land, you want to have a significant component of your property to be land. As Dave said, land to asset ratio, we're looking at least 70% of the value is in the land, rather than say the other way around, which means you're going to be losing money in regards to capital growth. And so far as looks is concerned, it's not just the look of the property, that is the style of the property or the character in the property, but it's also an outlook, the view. And the best view that you can get is a view of the sea. Second best view is a view of the city. Then after that is a view of, say, hills, large open space or range. And then is a view of maybe a smaller park or a reserve. So the three L's, if you can't remember the seven S's, location, land and looks.
Awesome.
Nicely done, Pete.
Fantastic gold nugget, Pete. All right, well, that brings to a close another episode of PPBP podcast.
Good acronym, Dave.
Yeah. I look forward to seeing you both next week.
So, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave.
Stay calm out there, folks. Stay calm.
Yes.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about selecting a quality investment asset, take a listen to episodes number 14, How to Choose a Location for Investment, What to Look For and What to Avoid. Episode 16, Unpacking Land to Asset Ratio. Episode 32, Misunderstanding What Makes a Good Property Investment, number 2 of the top 7 critical mistakes. Episode 42, Dissecting 10 years of CoreLogic data, capital cities and regional areas. Episode 48, Why Established Properties Outperform. And episode 61, How to Spot an Up-and-Coming Suburb, Understanding Demographics and Statistics.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice.
We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.